Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian today. The tune we're listening to is from a 1930s animated short called Laundry Blues. It aired on television in the 1930s, but it's now seen as a snapshot of pop culture stereotyping of Chinese people, something our next guest can tell us more about. Professor Jack Chen is a professor of Asian American Studies at NYU and co-founder and senior historian at the Museum of Chinese in America. He's here today to talk about a book he recently edited called Yellow Peril, an archive of anti-Asian fear. Jack Chen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Terrific being here.
Before we begin, a question for listeners. Have you seen any pop culture references to yellow peril mentality that have made you feel a little queasy? Maybe it's a movie trailer, a poster, a book that made you think, aren't we past that when it comes to how we represent Asians and Asian Americans? Call and let us know at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And we'd especially like to hear from Asian American listeners. But Jack, tell me the title of your book. It comes from a very loaded phrase used to describe anti-Asian fear. Help us unpack this. When did we start hearing about yellow peril?
The title is Yellow Peril! Exclamation mark. It's very important. So I think of that as a yikes, you know, kind of exclamation mark, an archive of anti-Asian fear. It's pervasive. It continues. It was more explicit at different points in time, especially in the 19th and early 20th century. But since then, we've gotten into a kind of a polite, ongoing practice of it, but not having the same kind of virulently racist caricatures that that we tend to associate with racism. But it actually continues to this day and has a huge impact on all sorts of issues, which we can talk about. I should maybe just start out by saying a little bit about Laundry Blues.
Yeah.
This kind of attitude and feeling is deeply ingrained in how we react to sounds, smells, tastes, right? So that that sound that people still associate with in terms of the quote-unquote Oriental difference. When you hear that kind of mincing music, you hear a certain kind of gong, you know, it automatically signals that as an introduction to something exotic and Oriental that's going to be entering the stage. That goes back deep into a 19th century theater craft, British theater craft, but coming into this country. And it continues to this day in more subtle ways. So even the movie Chinatown with Jack Nicholson, you don't hear the gong. But when you hear at the very end, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown, that line really replaces the gong, in effect. It gives the sense that, well, things are inscrutable. There's mysteries that can never be understood. So you have to kind of give up on that. Now, in fact, the film was nothing about Chinatown. It was strictly background and backdrop. But it's that feeling, that Oriental feeling, that is what signals this difference, either exotic and exciting, tantalizing, promising, or actually as a potential enemy and danger.
When you were putting together this collection of essays about anti-Asian fear, there's, of course, this history that Laundry Blues was depicting Chinese workers. Who are you including when you talk about who's included in Yellow Peril today and those cultural representations?
Well, the word yellow gives us a hint. As we begin to research how that term was used deep in terms of European history, we begin to discover, of course, just as the word Oriental was used, it was first referred to sometimes even Jews in the Eastern European area. This whole area of Eurasia, in some ways, is the discomfort border zone. And so the Middle East was first referred to the East, and as European and British kind of extension into Asia continued, then yellowness was associated further and further east until it kind of arrived into the coastal areas of China and Japan. But it wasn't that long before that yellow referred to something in the Middle East. And as yellow moved further east, then it was replaced with people who were considered brown or tawny. So the term yellow, actually, yellow peril includes really, I think, it's related deeply historically to Islamophobia and kind of fears of those who are brown and yellow and off color in some way from the Anglo-American point of view and the British point of view.
We have a collection of some of the cartoons that you feature in the book on our website. You can go to WNYC.org and click on the Brian Lehrer Show page. The cover photo on the collection is a globe and a yellow octopus with its tentacles encircling the globe with a very sort of conniving look on the octopus's face. Where did this image come from?
That comes from the cover of Simplicissimus, which was a German satirical magazine. It was actually penned by Erich Schilling, this was a social democratic publication, but then they increasingly, during the rise of fascism and Nazism, he himself became sympathetic to Hitler himself. So when Hitler committed suicide, he also committed suicide. This yellow octopus represents the rise of Japan, especially in its defeat of Russia. This was a battleship of the Western style that quickly emerged after the West kind of forced the opening of Japan to the West. So this signaled this fear that we can no longer extend our colonies without any significant resistance. Japan represented that kind of pushback, and in some ways it's the pushback that defines yellow peril historically.
And that pushback continues as far as even the use of that very same imagery. In 2010, in our Twitter feed, you can see there was an editorial, a political cartoon that featured a Google octopus coming up against a China octopus when it's dealing with, I think, privacy in 2010. So this octopus image still percolates our thinking about the Asian threat.
Absolutely, except that the China octopus has a pair of glasses.
Right? So, what does that mean?
So a lot of this stuff is just kind of crazy, amazing, and really fascinating to see these deep long-term patterns. The octopus is something that was used not just against Asians, but also against Jews, against communists, against all sorts of groups that were considered dangerous to the quote-unquote West. There's also strong images of the claw, the yellow claw, the Jewish man who's kind of grasping the world with his sharp, long, skinny fingernails, spider. These are very strong images that connect in all sorts of ways.
So let's talk about the historical flashpoints when this sense of yellow peril exclamation point fear has sort of had its gathering points. I mean, you would imagine World War II, as you said, with the book cover around that. You would assume also in the 19th century with immigration into the western part of the United States of Chinese immigrants. When else have we really seen these spikes?
We have to talk about Fu Manchu since that's part of the intro to the show. Besides the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II, besides the exclusion of Chinese for being seen as somehow too efficient laborers and unfair competition to white workers in the American West in the 1870s and 1880s, in some ways the key moment is with the Boxer Rebellion. It's really the Boxer Rebellion is kind of a broad-scale popular uprising that was against the missionaries and foreign occupation of China leading up to 1900. And when the pushback happened, it was a violent pushback. When that violent pushback happened, American and Western troops went into Beijing and basically occupied Beijing. news of this went all around the world. And this is the beginning in which Arthur Sarsfield Ward, a.k.a. Sax Rohmer, got the idea to write about this dangerously evil Fu Manchu, Dr. Fu Manchu, who had multiple degrees from all the top universities in England and Harvard, and was a medical doctor as well. And he came to embody the ultimate evil. And I, if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to read just a little passage from The Insidious Fu Manchu, which first appeared in Collier's Magazine, later became a book. I'll just read a little segment. Imagine a person tall, lean and feline, high-shouldered with a brow like Shakespeare and a face like Satan, a close shaven skull and long magnetic eyes of the true cat green. Invest him with all the cruel cunning of an entire Eastern race accumulated in one giant intellect and all the resources of science past and present, with all the resources, if you will, of a weakly government, which, however, already has denied all knowledge of his existence. Imagine that awful being, and you have a mental picture of Dr. Fu Manchu, the Yellow Peril incarnate in what man?
The Yellow Peril incarnate. What year was that published?
The book was published in 1913, but it started appearing in 1911. So Rohmer, who started appearing in these Oriental robes and becoming really kind of the Sherlock Holmes, you know, kind of, you know, kind of protagonist of his time, you know. He came up with this because he saw the headlines in the British newspapers and knew that if he played off this kind of news, he would have a ready audience. And in fact, this was the beginning of many, many books and, of course, radio series. And really the most famous, perhaps, is for Americans, is the 1932 Boris Karloff as Fu Manchu and Myrna Loy as his daughter. So it's deep, deep within American culture.
I'm Anna Sale, in today for Brian Lehrer. I'm speaking with Professor Jack Chen about his new book, Yellow Peril, an Archive of Anti-Asian Fear. This is WNYC FM HD in AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We're getting some calls about Yellow Peril cultural representations. Herb in Manhattan, you remember one in The Village Voice?
Yes, I did. It was a cartoon by Jules Pfeiffer, and it showed several panels, starting with a representation as a Chinese Mandarin type person, but and also looking like Fu Manchu. I remember Sax Rohmer's stories from when my childhood, and then it showed. I have it here somewhere, but I just can't find it right now. It showed, I think, Mao Zedong. And later on, it showed, I guess, a couple of others. And it ended up with the punchline, which was LBJ standing there in a soldier's uniform saying, "We Vietnamese all look like this."
And this was during the Vietnam War?
Yes.
Running in The Village Voice.
It was during LBJ's tenure.
Thanks for your call, Herb. Vernon on Staten Island, what did you want to mention?
Well, there are just a couple of things. One thing was during 1997, there was a big financial crisis that sort of engulfed Thailand, Indonesia, and China. And it was referred to in the media as the Asian contagion. And that struck me as very, very close to the Yellow Peril. That always bothered me.
Thanks for your call, Vernon. Jack, you smiled when you heard that. That's a reference you're familiar with.
Oh, boy, the word contagion and the thought that not only can people be polluted from this sound, these strange sounds, but also by close proximity. Part of the basis for the anti-Chinese laws that happened in the West Coast were the arguments that that the Chinese were the cause of all sorts of diseases that were plaguing folks in the cities. It wasn't the sewage. It wasn't these things. In some ways, it was kind of an early moment in which these things were being discovered more scientifically and medically. But it was this thought that somehow Asians and Chinese in particular, these bodies brought contagions from the West, and we still kind of play with that. The film Contagion, in fact,
I was
more recently.
Named Contagion.
Named Contagion with poor Gwyneth Paltrow returning from having eaten some pork at a Chinese restaurant in Hong Kong, dies. And that sets off a whole train of other people dying and the scientists, the American scientists, trying to figure out, you know, what the cause is. So this idea of something spreading, SARS as well, you know, when the SARS scare was happening in New York, and people were starting to hear rumors about not going to Chinatown and eating from Chinese food because of the fear, right? And it's similar to kind of HIV/AIDS fear as well, that it started, you know, if you coughed in the subway, you know, it's people would like turn around and start like staring at you. So these kinds of issues, you can see the elements of this kind of fear of the other and kind of identifying the other as a cartoon caricature.
You know, I want to ask you about that caricature because I think of two caricatures that sort of predominate representations of Asians and Asian Americans. The first is what we're speaking about, the idea that Asian influencers are somehow evil or insidious and kind of will come in when we're not expecting it. But then you also see representations of Asians and Asian men in particular of being weak, you know, emasculating them. How do those two fit together?
Well, and there's more. There's the there's Myrna Loy, who's the Dragon Lady, and then there's the model minority of the super achievers.
Exactly. You know,
very, very successful. They're all related on a continuum. As I was referring back to the Boxer Rebellion, you know, when there's pushback, when something happens, there's pushback, and the mainstream culture cannot acknowledge that in part they're involved in this in some way. Okay, then. And there's pushback. The tendency is to say, well, you know, they're different and that's why this is happening. It's not because, well, whether the British really should have been involved in the Opium Wars and kind of pushing it onto China and that's being denied. It's too hard to deal with. American involvement as well, that's too hard to deal with. But then the pushback is what people then associate. So I think there's a tendency for that to happen. In the case of, let's say, the weakly man, or the super strong man, that actually is part of the mainstream of how racial caricatures actually operate, from Native Americans, the savage, you know, Native brave with the tomahawk, you know, who's getting ready to scalp a white man or rape a white woman, to the lazy Mexican, to, you know, the African-American caricatures on the plantation eating watermelon, right? So we're really talking about that whole range of fantasy projections of being able to either control these people and control them in a sense because, well, we're justifying these attitudes because they're lazy. They're not hard Protestant, you know, kind of good workers, you know, that will be part of the system, or they're threatening to that very same system. So I think we're really always dealing with this hall of mirrors in which the self and the other is really as much about a projection of the uneasy relationship of the U.S. and the world, but also disavowed selves within oneself, right? You're thinking, well, I'm being lazy. I'm being told that I'm being lazy, but I'm not lazy. They're the ones who are lazy, right? They're projecting outwards.
So the projection is both needing to demonstrate that someone is menacing and also inferior simultaneously. So you get some of these mixed signals. Let's look at a more recent example. This is from a nonprofit ad from Citizens Against Government Waste. Let's take a listen.
当然，我们是他们的大债主。现在他们都得给我们干活。
You can change the future. You have to. Join Citizens Against Government Waste to stop the spending that is bankrupting America.
So this was a political ad just a few years ago. Tell us who ran this ad and the visual of what was happening when we heard those voices.
Well, it's from the Citizens Against Government Waste, and it aired around the country in 2010 and 2012 during election campaigns in parts of the nation in which the balance of who was going to win were up in the air. So it tended not to air, for example, in New York City. But it projects, and I encourage people to take a look at this. I think it's actually a very instructive cartoon that shows the continuity of how Yellow Peril continues to this day, but without the same kind of caricatures. But if you really just scratch the surface, it's there. It shows a very high-tech classroom. It's kind of a future classroom in which all sorts of screens, you know, just kind of pop out of nowhere, and all the students have the latest in technology, and the professor is very well groomed and has a microphone, and he's the Chinese professor. And it says it's Beijing 2030. So it's really this projection of a dystopic future in which he says, he opens with, why do great nations fail? And he goes into a whole thing really about the Greeks, the Romans, and the United States. Why did they fail? And basically it then becomes kind of the litany of kind of Republican arguments about, well, it's because of the debt and this and that. So the part that we hear in that little clip is that he's saying, well, you know, there's an enormous so-called stimulus spending, massive changes to the healthcare, government takeover of private industries, and crushing debt. Of course, we owned most of their debt. That's when he snickers.
And the crowd laughs.
And the crowd laughs. And then, so now they work for us. And then it ends with a very masculine, normative American English voice saying, you can change the future, you have to. Right, so this is really another version of that sonic kind of racism. You can hear it with the snicker, the foreign language, unintelligible, what is he saying, the subtitles, Americans' distrust for subtitles anyhow, but also when you view the sound with the images, it's really a very powerful, a very effective, ad, political ad, but it also is basically inaccurate because China does not own the American debt. And that's something that's hammered time and time again, but is actually deeply inaccurate.
Are we nearing another spike? When you pay attention to these representations all over the media landscape, you said you're not just looking at representations of East Asians and East Asian Americans, but also Islamophobic images. But does it feel to you in this moment in 2014, where are we on that ebb and flow of the pushback against the Asian influence?
We're on regular cycles of flashpoints. And it's a bit of a roller coaster, I would say, over the past number of decades. We've just come out of this incredible Islamophobic kind of moment. And as the U.S. is kind of pulling back in certain ways, it's actually instituting with drones. And the same thing happened in Vietnam, in which there's an air war. And at that point, the American public is not as deeply engaged personally in these issues and tends to not be as attuned to these kinds of questions about policies in Asia. So sometimes it leads up to a war, saber rattling, a kind of marshaling wartime propaganda happens, whether it's against Middle Eastern Arabs or Muslims or East Asians of various kinds. North Korea has become a favorite kind of caricatured representation. But I think with the debt ceiling argument coming up, and the fight over that, and the ongoing perception that China owns Americans' debt, which is not true. It's written, our founding fathers and various folks in the government have written in that there's no foreign country that can own the American debt, so that is still there. And it, if you look at the rate, it's really around 7-8%. That impression, that false idea, is something that is so prevalent that it's very easy to kind of pull together a chain of arguments so that if something were to happen in China, it could be, hacking. It could be the pollution scare. It could be SARS again. It could be a convergence of a number of issues that then are kind of focused in kind of a unfair way. It's as if China was focusing on all the little things that are different from China and therefore made into an argument about why China should invade the U.S., right? But that kind of thing contributes to a paranoia that then can be pushed by policymakers for a certain kind of objective.
And speaking of cultural representations of who is conniving and not to be trusted and who is strong and the winner, I just have to ask, what's it like for you to watch the Olympics as someone who studies cultural representations of nationalities and ethnic groups? What's it like to watch it?
It's something I think about, although I really do enjoy watching the Olympics. I mean, it's just amazing to see what people can do. of all athletes from all places. But, of course, national identity is played out so much. And when we watch any nation's representation of the Olympics, but in our case the U.S. representation, we get these little human portraits of the American, right? And then we look at, let's say, the downhill woman skier Switzerland, and she looks like an American, you know, the way Americans will think. Or if we see, let's say, a Russian performer who looks Asian, then we, well, wait a minute, that person is Russian, they're Asian? Russia has always been kind of on the edge. Is it part of Europe or is it actually Asian, right? So I think things begin to kind of change. Also notions of what fairness is with the skaters, for example. Is it fair that they work together somehow? And perhaps is it unfair competition? So these things are very subtle, but we have seen a number of instances in which, let's say, an Asian American performer on the American team is thought of as a foreigner and represented that way, and then apologies happen after protests happen. So there is still that tendency that's really just beneath the surface in which these perceptions of difference play out. Usually I know that if I'm on the radio, people hear my voice, they tend to be more open to things I'm saying. But if they see me, they immediately see my Asian-looking appearance and dissociate the sense that they can easily understand or agree with what I'm saying. So there is that kind of tendency that I think many Asians feel in this country. One of the things that's a common and rather tired joke is we're always asked, you know, where are you from? And when I say Wisconsin and I grew up in the Midwest on the prairie, they said, no, where are you really from? Well, I'm an American citizen. I was born in this country. No, where are you really, really from, right? So that becomes a very tired kind of question that so many people are asked.
Jack Chen is a professor of Asian American Studies at NYU and the co-founder and senior historian at the Museum of Chinese in America. He recently edited a book called Yellow Peril, an Archive of Anti-Asian Fear. And again, you can see some of the images we discussed on the Brian Lehrer Show page. Go to WNYC.org, click on the Brian Lehrer Show. Thanks for coming in, Jack.
Sure, it's my pleasure. And I should say that Dylan Yates, who's one of my undergraduate students and now as a PhD student, did this book with me. So
congratulations,
so
Dylan,
credit
to you as well. I'm Anna Sale in for Brian Lehrer. Coming up, we'll look at the lobbying effort and who's funding it for and against the minimum wage in Washington, D.C.